He says, most people believe the mind to be a mirror, more or less accurately reflecting the world outside of them, not realizing, on the contrary, that the mind itself is the principal element of creation. The Buddha put it slightly differently in saying that all experience is born of mind, led by mind, preceded by mind. All that I am arises with my thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. We left off is perhaps reflecting on how much we're able to acknowledge that we are indeed the architects of our experience. That with our perceptions and thoughts, we are constructing our world of the moment. And we inhabit those constructions, and we react to life from their foundations. Moment to moment, what we see in our experience is the way that our sense doors, including the mind, are interfacing with the world inwardly and outwardly. Sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, and thoughts. Registering in consciousness moment to moment, we perceive them. We perceive them. We have a name for them. We have a name for them. This is the sign that is placed upon them. Clock, chair, bell. This is the sign that is placed upon them. This is a part of perception. The name or the sign pretty much that is designated pretty much sums up the reality of what is perceived. Just as our name tends to be the standard bearer for all we believe ourselves to be. Wittgenstein put it, he said, words present us with a picture, and the picture holds us captive. The words present us with a picture, and the picture holds us captive. Now, I want to unpack this a little bit. Clearly, perception is part of consciousness. We cannot do without it. There are many perceptions that are quite simply means of navigating our way through life. Because I know this is a bell and this is a cushion, I know not to sit on the bell, but to sit on the cushion. You know the hot water dispenser delivers, so you don't try to get at the water from the toilet. So many of our perceptions are very simply means of navigating our ways through life, neither good nor bad, ethically neutral, simply a way of getting through our days. But perception is not innocent. There is no perception that is innocent. Perception, of course, carries with it all of the associations of the past. I ring the bell. It can evoke a flood of memories of how we've what that bell has meant to us in the past. The dread of another sitting, the relief of the ending of a sitting, The joy of coming to another sitting, the joy of leaving a sitting. But we see this perception opens up that doorway, doesn't it? There's no perception that is innocent. Perception is loaded with association, with how we've seen the sight in the past. We hear the sound of a bird, and it reminds us of where we were when we last heard that bird, what kind of bird it is, whether it's a bird we like, whether it's a bird we don't like. The memories of how we felt a sensation in the body before. We need to only have a twinge in the knee, and we have memories. You may have had an illness in the past that registered in the body in a certain way. You only need to have a twinge in your stomach, and you're cast back into the days of stomach cancer. We can see how perception and memory are essentially interwoven. And so perception and memory are running on the same neural pathways. We interact with a person. You may only need to arrive here today, and you catch sight of a person in the hallway. Maybe a person you've had a wonderful conversation with in the past, and you make plans for your lunchtime walk. Maybe a person who, you know, you sat a retreat with, who was your, you know, restless neighbor. And immediately the perception is kind of designating that person in a particular way. It happens almost unconsciously. The person at the front of the food line, we go outside and see a pair of shoes in the middle of the hallway, we know exactly who left them there. Because they always leave them there. And they're a very unmindful person, because they leave them there. But perception, drawing on association, of course means that we very rarely see anything anew. We very rarely see anything anew. But through the lens of the past, there's a kind of freeze framing, a sign making. The Buddha refers to this as sign-making. Now, perception feeds not only upon past association. That past association then, in turn, evokes past experience, interpretation, and reaction. The likes, the dislikes, the fears, the wanting. If I've sat in a meditation room and there happens to be a person who, you know, chronically comes late to sittings and opens the door, I can sit there with my eyes closed and I only need to hear the opening of the door to move so quickly into feeling the waves of aversion arising. They're doing it again. We haven't even seen, it could be a completely new person. But we feel the waves of aversion arising. So the perception, the memory, the association, the reactions associated with that past experience arise into consciousness. And then we say, well, they are actually such an inconsiderate person. We have placed a sign upon them. This sign making. We have placed a label, a designation upon them. We can walk outside and see a person whose eyes remind us of our father and be catapulted back into childhood anxieties. Perception, sign making, says I am, you are, that is wonderful, that is terrible, that is desirable, that is undesirable, that is lovely, that is gross. The whole range of associations and reactions. So we see that the sign making, the tendency to make signs, make designations, activates underlying tendencies, activates aversion, activates greed, activates fear, activates suspicion. We can see how that happens so quickly in our consciousness. We are constructing our world on the moment. So if we can see that process, perception, association, memory, past experience, past reactions, activation of underlying tendencies, and then, of course, it should be no surprise to us that we find ourselves walking in the same psychological and emotional circles over and over again. It is how the Buddha defined samsara, walking in circles. Walking in circles of emotional reactivity, walking in circles of psychological construction and building. Now, sign making and the whole retinue of associations keeps the world fixed and seen in particular ways. There's not a lot of room for adaptation in there. You know, that inconsiderate person who always leaves her shoes in the middle of the hallway may very well remain for the rest of our lives an inconsiderate person. We keep the world fixed and seen in particular ways, good, bad, lovely, unlovely, but we keep ourselves fixed and locked into a sense of self that feels eternal. Because this is not just projected outwardly, exactly the same process happens inwardly, where we construct a world of self, a world of experience that I occupy the center of, that feels eternal. I am, I always have been, I always will be. Blake once wrote that if the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite. There's a basic formula that operates certainly in Buddhist psychology and understanding world construction. Where the Buddha says what we contact, the meeting of the sense door and the sensory information, including the mind and thoughts, that what we contact, we feel. What we feel, we perceive. What we perceive, we think about. What we think on, we proliferate about. What we proliferate about becomes the shape of our mind. It's a basic formula of world construction. Happening thousands of times in a single day. That what we contact, we feel. What we feel, we perceive. What we perceive, we think about. What we think about, we proliferate about. What we proliferate about becomes the shape of our mind and indeed becomes the shape of our world. This is the process of construction. The sign making comes in the perception. So at the heart of the Buddha's teaching, when he speaks about liberation, he quite frequently uses this phrase, the signless deliverance of the heart, the signless deliverance of the mind, the freedom from the constructing process, the freedom from fixing the world, ourselves, into something very finite. Perhaps when we look most deeply at our experience, we see that there is nothing that is fixed in this world apart from our view of it. That's quite interesting. That there is nothing fixed in this world apart from our view of it. Now, what would that do to us? What would that do to our way of relating? If we truly could see that, what would that do to our way of relating, our way of, you know, being present at perception, our way of seeing ourselves, our way of seeing others? What if we could really see that? What would that do to all our opinions, our labels about this is bad, this is good, you know, this is desirable, not desirable? If we could actually really see that nothing is fixed in place apart from our view of it, what would that do to our consciousness? What would that do to our way of being? Oh, actually, I'd like some answers to that.
We can't assume we know anything. Really, I mean, ultimately, because everything is changing, so we can't really know.
It would bring us into a state of resting and not knowing. Into a place of curiosity, almost a place of wonder. You know, the willingness to be informed rather than the compulsion to know. That would be a big thing. That I let you inform me as how you're changing, you know, fluid, responsive, rather than me knowing or insisting that you be a certain way. There is a lot of attachment to sign making. It makes the world familiar. It makes the world feel safe. It almost gives us a ready-made set of reactions. You know, if I'm a Manchester United supporter, I know to hate Manchester City. You know? I know they're the bad guys. You know, if I have a particular prejudice, I actually like to gather around me people who have the same prejudice so that we can share in our constructions and actually we can feel even more certain in our knowing and that almost more certain in our safety and our place in the world, our place in the universe. Questioning our perceptions means allowing ourselves to be taught, allowing ourselves to be informed, to be able to rest in actually the lack of certainties, the lack of insistence. Anybody else got any answers about what would happen to us if we released our grasp? Yes, and it might give us some choices about responsiveness too. I might not hear the door open and feel that immediately the only possibility is to feel aversion. I might feel curiosity about, oh, you know, who's there? What's going on? Maybe I could have some metta. Maybe that person is chronically late because they're disabled. You know, maybe there's another opportunity. So it could give us that opportunity of more choices rather than feeling as dictated to by the reactions that seem to be so interwoven with the perceptions.
It can give us a lot of freedom.
Yep.
Maybe it could heal old wounds too by having one way of always seeing experience. Feeling the pain of that, and then when you go, oh, that's not what this is about,
yeah.
You can then go, well, maybe that wasn't what it was about back then either, that kind of healing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be much quieter.
Yes. There is that. If you go back to that formula of what we contact, we feel, we perceive, what we perceive, we think about and proliferate about, how many of our signs seem to catapult us in that kind of proliferation and agitation of, you know, explaining, legitimizing, ensuring. What? To do what?
To be able to see without placing
signs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm thinking of a technique drawing on the right side of the brain where you turn the picture upside down so that you can't see that you know it. And I've done it with little kids.
Yeah.
And then they turn it right side up and it's like their drawing is so much more detail, and it's like if you already know what it is, you don't really see it. You know, I think of children,
yes,
when they first are,
yes,
young, everything is like, what is this? But then I think of how I can just miss so many things because they don't even come through.
It is true. I mean, it's the capacity to rest in not knowing actually invites mindfulness. It invites attention. Where the certainties of knowing almost seem to invite a kind of mindlessness. We don't need to question anything. You know, we don't need to pay attention because I know this. I know you. I don't need to pay attention to you.
We might be able to see how our certainties have walled us in,
yeah,
and imprisoned us.
Yeah. Yeah. When Blake says, you know, if the doors of perception were cleansed, you know, cleansed of the reactivity, cleansed of the underlying tendencies, that the world would appear as it is, infinite. I mean, I often feel that what we do in meditative practice, in a way, is to inch our way towards the intimate, infinite. But a lot of it is through that willingness to unpack the constructions, to have that sense of questioning, to have that sense of curiosity, of, you know, maybe things are not the way we assumed them to be. Now, what would happen if we could foster that same not knowing in relationship to ourselves? I mean, all of the things you have said, you know, are, of course, it's completely true and wonderful. But what would happen if we could turn that same not knowing to ourselves? How many certainties do we have about who we are? You know, I'm a stressed out person. You know, do we not hear this a lot in our conversations, and perhaps we say it ourselves, you know, I'm a very anxious person and I'm an extrovert. You know, I'm shy, I'm timid, you know, I'm fearful, you know, I'm depressed. I'm anxious, you know, I'm attractive, not. You know? Think of your autobiography. Think of your autobiography. It's a big one, often. But what would it be like to be able to bring that same not knowing to the signs that we have placed upon our own being? That carry the same certainties, often carry the same often underlying tendencies and reactions, don't they? Of self-judgment, of self-aversion, all rooted in the sign-making that I am. I am. Now, what would that do inwardly? To be able to move from that sign-making, those fixed perceptions applied to ourselves to a place of not knowing. We can see what difference it would make outwardly, what difference it might make in our relationships to others. What would it do inwardly? Because this is one of the places often of greatest certainty. I mean, sometimes our descriptions change, but we pretty much have this certainty that I am. You know, I am the body, I am the mind, I am the emotions, I am the reactions of the moment. This is who I am, what we contact, we feel, we perceive, you know, we proliferate about, it becomes the shape of our mind, it becomes the shape of ourself. And when you go through those loops a million times, they assume a credibility and authority that says, this is indeed who I am. In this practice, of course, we're not suggesting anyone surrenders perception, becomes disabled in life. It's good to wake up in the morning and to know you're in the right bed. It's good to know, it's even better to know the person who's beside you. We're not suggesting that you suddenly forget where you live. You know, that you don't have an address. You know, or that you turn up at the wrong workplace. Clearly that's not the suggestion here. But can we perceive, navigate our way through life skillfully, but knowing that perceptions are empty of self? They are empty of solidity. Whether that is perception of me, or whether it is the self that is invested through the signs we place upon all things. The sign actually becoming the self. The chair becomes the self. The bell becomes the self. In the window becomes the self. Can we navigate our way through the world but to know that all perceptions are empty of self? If we can do that, what actually happens is that we sever the link between perception and the underlying tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion. We sever the link between perception and the underlying tendencies of greed, hatred, delusion, including the delusion of self-making. Including the delusion of self-making. Then there is the possibility of wonder. There's a possibility of seeing anew. There's a possibility of curiosity. There's a possibility of resting much more easily in not knowing, and the willingness to be taught by the moment rather than the superimposing of our signs upon all things. There's huge implications of this. Think of compassion as our capacity to liberate other people from our perceptions of them. How our perceptions of others, you know, turns them into a fixed entity that can never change, actually. It's not permitted to change, even. Liberating the world and other people from our perceptions and our definitions and our signs is actually what liberates also us to see all things anew. And then I think there are the choices you spoke of. Then the capacity to respond with metta, with compassion, with joy, and most importantly, to know an unshakable equanimity. Because when the Buddha talks about the signless deliverance of mind, of severing the link between perception and the underlying tendencies, he's actually talking about blowing out the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. What is the promise of that? It actually liberates us to be also a fluid, changing, unfolding being. not fixed anywhere. To not define or fix is equanimity without signs. Creating no self creates no other. Its implication is to be a participant in an awakened, unfolding mandala of life that has no center. That has no center. When no center of self is created. And that is actually a pretty remarkable liberation. It's a pretty remarkable liberation. Okay, so we have some time.
When I have those moments of seeing the story I'm telling about someone and how I've captured them or myself in a box, I think it's hilarious. And that humor, is that, I feel like that's the same, it's a kind of a joy. For some reason I find it really helpful. I just start to laugh sometimes the way I decided what something is, when really I don't have any idea.
I mean, it's great if you can feel some joy in seeing that, but I think it's also really important to appreciate the very lethal consequences of doing this, because it's not that we do it individually only, we do it collectively. It's why we fight wars. It's why we have racism. It's why we have, you know, all the isms, because we have a collective sign-making that actually evokes as underlying tendencies. So there is a certainly a sense of wonder in actually seeing the emptiness of the story, if we can really live it. And also appreciating the enormous suffering that is created through not seeing the emptiness of our sign making.
You mentioned about perception and thought and proliferation, and I usually notice it as sort of a neurotic proliferation or obsession, and that's where I'm thinking maybe I should put more focus on the proliferation, but are you saying that you can actually back it up and start
yes.
with the perception?
Well, it's always a question of where you can actually bring mindfulness. You know, clearly when there's a lot of proliferation, it really camouflages what has gone before. So it actually does camouflage, you know, the contact moment. The feeling tone, really critical, of pleasant or unpleasant or neither. How that stimulates, you know, the movement into perception. Contact, feeling, and perception are pretty much simultaneous. They're pretty much simultaneous. But then that's the kind of breeding ground of beginning to proliferate. So you actually really have to be very, as clear as you can be about where you can access. Now, proliferation clouds what has gone before because it seems like such a quick launch pad, you know. Certainly, there is a huge, huge value in beginning to develop the skills to calm the proliferation. To calm the proliferation. Because the more that we can train our own minds and our own hearts to not engage in that proliferation, the closer we can get actually to the contact moments where our world is actually arising. And, you know, that's part of that kind of curiosity. I mean, there's a place where the, you know, bearing in mind when the Buddha speaks about the world, he's always speaking about the world of experience. You know, he's not speaking about phenomena. He's speaking about the world of experience. You know, he says, like, on contact, the world arises. With the cessation of contact, there is a cessation of the world. So he's talking about this arising of the personal world. He says, the foolish seek to pursue contact, and the wise seek to understand it. So it's actually how we come to that place where we're beginning to really being able to trace in our own consciousness the process of constructing. Very often we start with a retrospective awareness, don't we? we look back and there's been some huge psychological or emotional storm, you know, where there's been a big world construction, you know, and we're sure it's the truth and sure it's reality. And then something pops it, usually actually another moment of contact. And then we come out the other end and we look back and we say, well, what was that all about? But that's often where we start. You know, that's not a bad thought. What was that all about? You know, rather than, oh, I shouldn't have done that and I did that again. What was that all about? It's actually a pretty good thought. Because it's actually beginning to question some of those bubbles that are created that seem so definite, so fixed. And that questioning, of course, is beginning to start to be more familiar with the building blocks. With the building blocks of the bubbles, with the process itself. And, you know, sometimes we notice it here, and sometimes we notice it here. And sometimes we notice it early on, and sometimes we notice it later. It doesn't matter, in a way, what point you begin to notice it. What's most important is that there's a curiosity that evokes the mindfulness to really bring that question, not only what is going on, but is it actually true? Is it helpful?
It occurs to me, if I'm able to sever that link of those locked in fixed perceptions, that I open myself up to seeing all the potential, the possibility in not only myself, but in my world and in everyone else, instead of limiting them to this, as somebody said, box.
It sounds
exciting, albeit difficult.
Yeah.
I want it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you speak to, you spoke a lot about how we got to kind of where we are with lying and what we say about ourselves, that it's so true to us and that it really isn't true. But how does one start chipping away at all those?
At the I structure? At the self structure?
That's just gotten so strong over so many years of practicing. Just to kind of reverse it.
I don't think there's one way. I think there's many ways. In many ways, I think the whole of the practice is, in a sense, dedicated to deconstructing the constructions. I think there's many ways. I mean, for example, when we speak about, say, contemplating impermanence, it has a pretty major implication if we really understand it. This construction is a construction of the moment. That's it. We see it arising, we see it passing, we see it replaced by another, we see the ending of that, we see that arising, we see that passing. If we really contemplate that in a very sustained way, we're likely to start to get some wise doubt arising about the constructions when they happen. One of the ways that the Buddha talks about, of course, quite frequently in the discourses, is an applied investigation. That whenever there's the awareness, the mindfulness of the contracted constructions, to bring the questions to it of, or actually not questions, actually, he would say, this is not me, this does not belong to me, this is not who I am. Apply that to our thought processes. Apply it to the body. Apply it to a particular storm. Apply it to a view. You know, apply it to a sense of possession. This is not me. This does not belong to me. This is not who I am. You know, there's a tremendous emphasis in this practice around repetition. You know, repeat, 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 repeat. Not as a kind of, you know, just kind of conceptual repeating. But it's almost like changing one's frameworks. And to change our frameworks, you know, as you say, many of those frameworks are so habitual and so embedded, it involves that sustained questioning. So it's almost like you can pick different threads up. You know, if we see the statements that suddenly say, I am, or you are, what is it like to have the willingness in a sustained way just to flip that around and say, am I? Are you? It's loosening the glue of the certainties. Loosening the glue of the certainties. There is also something, of course, to be said for deepening an inner stillness and calmness to the degree that we are really present with the process. Because we think in terms, you know, I mean, the whole teaching, of course, the whole Pali language is a language and a teaching of process. We are not talking about fixed things. You know, conceptually in English, we think in terms of nouns, you know, this, that, this, that. We don't actually talk so much in terms of process. But when we actually deepen in our practice and deepen in mindfulness, what we actually really do begin to sense is a world of process and a world of conditions in a constant interface and matrix. We don't see anything that's fixed. You know, if you really contemplate inwardly, we don't see a single thing that is fixed apart from our views. And there is something that is incredibly liberating about that, to really know that, feel that experientially, feel that fluidity, feel that unfolding, changing mandala of process and conditions. And then, you know, we see that the only inclination to try and make something fixed is fear. And it's sometimes the anxiety of me. You know, but our actual experience is quite different than the views that we hold. You know? And there's something in experiential practice that is actually leading us or inviting us to actually live in line with our actual experience rather than our views. Our views might make the world more certain, but they don't make our world more free.
Yesterday you were talking about pausing, and it seems like slowing down the response process would be really helpful, and it's so counter to how I, and I guess a lot of people, get a lot of strokes for being quick, prompt, and active, and sharp, and all of that, but slowing that whole thing down and pausing seems to be where the access to mindfulness and asking those questions. I don't know if just...
No, you're quite right. I mean, it is... I think there's a pretty familiar phenomena for many people that the moment that we open our mouths, we lose connection with inner listening. You know, and a lot of engagement with the world involves clearly speaking and communication. And I'm not suggesting that we go through the world silent, but I think there's a tremendous art and skill in being able to speak without sacrificing mindfulness of of inner listening. Because we see very often that the moment that we're reacting, we're doing, we actually move much more into a kind of conceptual framework rather than a felt framework. Actually, you know, the Buddha says in one of the discourses that without mind, when there's no mindfulness of the body, there is no mindfulness at all. Which is kind of interesting. What it is to actually be embodied while thinking, while speaking, you know, to have that kind of ground of mindfulness in the body. And I think that is the way that we slow it down. That's
arrogance. Oh. That's fear. That's whatever it is. So what you're saying now, just about without mindfulness of the body, mindfulness just seems like it's about that.
Well, I mean, I think there is some truth in saying that many of the lessons of mindfulness and of insight that are applied to the mind, to the heart, are actually the lessons that have first been learned within the body. You know, and it's about learning to listen to mental states in the body, learning to listen to emotions in the body, learning to have that kind of ground. It's actually not a surprise that it's the first foundation of mindfulness. And in reality, certainly in the Satipatthana, the mindfulness of the body is given far more press than any other of the foundations. Because it is, you know, we see the flight from the body, particularly in terms of habitual reactions, impulses, you know, reactivity, you know, of ill will or, you know, wanting or justifying. I mean, we see the flight from the body so quickly and so many times in the day. And there is something about being so familiarized with that anchor, you know, of being embodied, that the kind of leap into simply the cognitive world is not so quick, and it doesn't become so divorced from the somatic world. And learning to have these two interwoven, you know, is one of the primary jobs of mindfulness training. And it's truly helpful. It is truly helpful. And it's where we learn many of the skills and the lessons that are applied to the cognitive.
When you were talking about equanimity, I had a wave of sadness about somebody I love who I perceive as causing herself and other people harm. And then I went to compassion for the pain of it. But then the question comes up, especially as this theme developed about perception, who's suffering? You know, am I suffering with my perception of her being kind of boiled down to these actions that I see? I don't see the rest of her life. I guess as I look at perception and fixing her in that place, I wonder.
Well, I mean, it sounds to me, it sounds to me like it's something you would need to check in with more, you know, to look at this. I mean, there aren't easy answers. You know, many of the complexities of human relationship have so many different qualities interwoven into them, you know, wholesome and unskillful, all coexisting. You know, views and insights all coexisting. And, you know, I think part of the job of our practice is to begin to unpack that a little and to have that discernment about, you know, what is helpful, what is unhelpful, you know, what is view, what is, you know, mana, what is actually metta and compassion and care, to be able to unpack that within ourselves. Because, you know, discernment is such a big aspect of mindfulness, you know, to really have that discernment, that questioning, because that's actually the basis of wise action, of compassionate action, you know, of metta acts. This is that discernment of knowing what to cultivate, what to let go of, you know, what to follow through, what is actually really just entangling us in confusion. And it is very, you know, I think far too often mindfulness is perceived as this kind of one-dimensional act of paying attention. That's a completely different word in Pali, paying attention. You know, it's not sati. You know, mindfulness actually is always cooperating with this range of other skillful qualities. So it's something very dynamic that includes investigation, includes discernment, includes metta, you know, all of these qualities that are necessary for mindfulness to be complete. But it's not just about paying attention. You know, this attention can be wholesome or unwholesome, but it's not sati. It's not mindfulness. So that's part of that journey, is to actually bring the whole family in. You know, something I'm not clear about, well, let's bring some investigation in. Let's bring some attention in, you know. Let's bring some discernment in. Let's bring some equanimity in, you know. It's the whole family gets invited to the party, you know, as a means of kind of unpacking it some.